All right, welcome to another episode of Bozo on the Bus. I'm going to stop counting episodes here, I think, after the next one, because that'll be 10. So today's episode 9. I'm here with David Frasconi, a friend, colleague, and bandmate. And welcome, David.
Hello.
Good to join us today. A little note for our regular listeners of this podcast. Today we're going to be switching over a little bit from the traditional recovery sobriety vein that we follow. And you're going to notice some changes in some of the podcasts coming forward, that we'll be exploring some different aspects to what it means to be a bozo on the bus. Just another bozo on the bus. But today we're going to start with David, and let's just kind of begin with a little bit of your bozo story, and what that would mean for you is, you know, whatever that kind of you remember as far as growing up. And you grew up in the South, I guess, or
right? So in the Dallas, Texas area, very conservative. I was raised a racist. I mean, it's just what happens there. It ended up being a bit of a problem child, and I'll get back to the racist part later. But
You don't see, as you said that, you didn't sound very proud of being a racist.
No, it goes back to the lies your parents tell you, you know, that they feel are real and you hold as truths your whole life. Well, every one of those truths that gets proven false for me later in life bothers me. It bothers me for the length of time I was ignorant and didn't know any better. And it goes from glass being a liquid down to, you know, other things that are just plausible but not true and I've carried around as truths my whole life.
Which is one thing that we'll definitely talk about today is the idea of what confirmation bias is, too, because that's one of those things. We learn from our parents and we develop an early bias about things, and not just our parents, but our communities, our community leaders, spiritual leaders, teachers, so on and so forth, and other family members, of course, too.
Well, I was floored when I got to college, and I went to Georgia Tech, and so it's in downtown Atlanta. Atlanta is a very African-American city. I know it's well over 50% black, and I was amazed when I went to college, and probably not half the students, but at least 40% of the students, I'll bet, were also African-American at Georgia Tech. And none of them were dumb, and they didn't steal from me, and they weren't criminals, and it was really difficult like understanding just how bad my indoctrinated racism that I didn't even know I had was, because, you know, I was a good person. I assumed this was just a cultural thing, but I never questioned the fact,
right?
You know, that these were just terrible people. Uh-huh. I just felt sorry for them because they couldn't help themselves.
I see.
You know, that sounds like a very terrible thing to say, and it is, but that was my mindset at the time, you know, just coming off of the being wrong my whole life.
Well, and this is how you were indoctrinated, right?
Exactly.
And I know this is tongue-in-cheek. I mean, I know you, and our listeners are going to get to know you really quickly, that you say these things, and there's this tongue-in-cheek aspect to them, because you know the absurdity of them as you're saying them.
Yes.
And being brought up that way and kind of going from there and learning and seeing life from different perspectives and having all these different influences, all of a sudden a lot of those that domestication begins to fall apart a little bit. It begins to almost crumble.
Oh, exactly. And you start looking at other things. It made me revisit, honestly, everything my parents and my peers and everything had taught me, because obviously there were lies in there. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that anything was malicious. It's just growing up. You know, my parents believed what they believed, and they taught it to me, and I disagree.
<You know? laughs> And frankly, Scarlett, I disagree.
That's right.
Okay. All right. I cut you off there because I went back to the racism issue, which is one that we explore here, because it comes out in so many different ways, and there are biases that get explored in so many different ways in these podcasts. But you were saying you were growing up and in this area of Texas, and to kind of go back and kind of...
Yeah, so it's a very conservative... we had the blue laws, and I mean actual lights turned off in grocery stores on the shelves where you couldn't buy that particular food because it wasn't kosher. Uh-huh. I know I'm mixing metaphors.
That's okay. Yeah, I understand them.
So we came from tight liquor laws and, you know, just very Bible belty things. So moving to Atlanta when I went to college was amazing because there were no rules. In Atlanta, I mean, liquor had, you had to go to a liquor store, but that was it. Mm-hmm. It was, there are strip clubs everywhere. It was very seedy. It was a very quick awakening. Mm-hmm. So the South is a strange place. And
are you saying that in perspective now that you live in the West, the Mountain West, or is it? Did you think that back then too?
Oh, I thought it back then. Okay. Every time I went somewhere normal, and Atlanta was very normal when compared to Dallas.
Sure.
However, Atlanta was very blue belty and religious still when compared to, say, California or New York.
Sure. Oh, most definitely.
I think California is more, at least with the things that the religions like to repress in the South, California seems way more open than even New York. Mm-hmm. New York seems to have more liquor laws. I mean, the thing that surprised me moving to California was I went into a Walgreens and there was a pyramid built of Jack Daniels. Yeah. And
well, you know, it is a drugstore.
Exactly. Well, I mean, I don't want to come off about like I rate every city with their liquor. But when you walk into a Walgreens and see a giant pyramid of Jim Beam, which would be illegal in every other state I'd lived in, it's just extremely out of place and odd. Or to see liquor on sale. You're not allowed to have sales of liquor. Well, places that are less religious do.
Yeah.
So now moving to Utah compared to the South, that was the closer correlation. And in fact, moving here, there are a lot of angry non-Mormons in Utah, particularly the ones raised here. They are very angry about their religion and all the wrongs that the local, you know, popular religion has caused them. And every time they start complaining, I just start showing them how it's worse in the South. The laws are more restrictive.
Yes.
And I think what you were remembering from before is I said the laws here are very weird. They're just not restrictive.
Yeah, they're a little skewed.
Yeah, they're, you know what they're trying to do, and they do the opposite. When I first moved here, I noticed that the beers were very strong. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to go to the liquor store to get them. It's a weird, like I said, weird laws, but they're extremely strong compared to other cities. And I was talking to a local Mormon about this, and he couldn't believe it that when they made their laws, you know, saying that you could only be a certain percentage to be in the grocery store, and over that had to be in the liquor store. That all these beer companies lost their minds and just went insane with the percentages, and everything's like 8 to 11%, and you can hurt yourself.
That's right.
And so what's happened in Utah is exactly the opposite of what the laws were intended for.
Exactly.
They're intended to make beer weak so that binge drinking wasn't as much of a problem. Sure. And instead they've just made beers twice or three times as strong as normal, and that you just have to go to the liquor store to get them.
And this is that interesting part that where we don't create any middle ground for moderation. And one of the things that David also is a reader and editor of the book Recovering the Seed. So I just outed you, just so you know.
Typos weren't mine.
Yeah, right. I take accountability for all the errors in there. They were mine, and I actually went back and put some in just, you know. Anyway, enough said. It has been edited again, and the new version is out. But this whole issue of how moderation, how laws actually make it more difficult to moderate in healthy ways because they're so restricted. So people have a tendency to abuse or binge on substances, and not everyone. Okay, I mean, this is not, again, this is not one size fits all. But the environment does create maybe an underlying psychology for some, and definitely a schema for others, where they put themselves in situations that they may not normally have done if the laws hadn't been so restrictive. I think your use of explaining, you know, you buy beer in the liquor store and the alcohol volume was much higher than it would be in the grocery store.
Well, it's also much higher than most states.
Yeah.
It's been this jump. And to your point with the, you know, with people kind of going overboard and with the binging, I think judgment has a lot to do based on that. I mean, when I was in college, I binge drank. And I binge drank because I was underage and I was poor. So we would, you know, chug whatever we could to try to, you know, pre-lubricate before going out to the bars where the drinks would be $10 if we could get one, you know, with a fake or whatever. And that binging was mainly trying to hide from the law. And so I mentioned I was a little bit of a problem child in school. I ended up getting sent to a boarding school run by Benedictine monks, which, I mean, I could fill podcasts with that. It's yeah, I'm a survivor. So I've managed to survive the Benedictine monastery and actually made some great friends. I almost sent my kids there, except I wasn't strong enough. I was too greedy. I didn't want to be without my children, but I think it probably would have helped.
You wanted to be an active, engaged parent. Is that what you're trying to say?
No, I like my kids. I just wanted to hang out. You're putting way too much altruism into this decision. It was Tammy and I did not want to be without our children. It was purely selfish.
We wanted them around.
I mean, you could try to spin it into a good parent thing. I'd just assure you it's not.
Okay.
But this was actually a interesting school. It was very inexpensive, and a very good school. And those things don't normally come together.
Good school and inexpensive, right.
And in fact, they had to raise their prices not because they needed the money. I mean, it was run by a monastery, and all these guys have taken a vow of poverty. They don't make money.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
We ate the food that they grew on their farm.
Yeah.
And so they really had no expenses.
Most of them don't even drive.
Yeah. Well, they don't drive, and most of them forget how as well, because they just don't.
There's farm trucks.
And I mean, a lot of them do drive. They have to go to the city. Some of them have parishes all around, and they're teachers, and, you know, there's bus drivers. But you're right. You know, the monastery probably had 100 monks or so, maybe only a quarter of those were involved in the school. And, you know, another half were involved in the monastery itself, and I mean, another quarter, coming up to half. And a lot of them had parishes just all around the area where they would also run the – I mean, there were two kinds of monks. There were the priests and the brothers. And the brothers were just – had given their lives, but they weren't priests.
Yeah.
The priests would run parishes and all over – this was a little school in the middle of Arkansas. But my point bringing it up is we were completely controlled. I mean, we had study halls. Our days were planned out. It was very, very, very rigid. And going from that to college, where I didn't even have to show up to class, much less do homework or go to my dorm at night. I mean, I went from an extremely rigid, structured life to no structure. And, you know, it's obvious in my grades. I almost flunked out several times. I did end up eventually dropping out, but that was once I, you know, I'd already had a job offer.
So what I heard hearing is that you weren't quite prepared for being on your own, growing up in a very structured environment where you were accountable pretty much 24 hours a day to somebody.
That was me. I didn't do very well. But where I was going to was I went to a party with some students that had been in that school, was looking for the bathroom, made a wrong turn, and kids were smoking crack. Now, this was late 80s. Crack was only in the ghettos. It was something you heard about on TV. I'd never seen it. I'd heard of it, but it just – socioeconomically, I should not have run into that ever. And I did. And that's just how brutal that tons of structure to no structure can be.
Interesting.
And moving here, I noticed the same thing. In Utah, and I mean, I've lived downtown Atlanta. I usually live in cities.
Okay.
I've got a tattoo. I see tattoos and piercings all the time. Moving here, I have never seen more gauges and tattoos than on the youth in the Salt Lake City area.
Interesting.
And I think it is exactly the same thing. I think it's these kids rebelling from a very structured church, you know, when they hit their college age, which is around the time I was, and stuff can get really, really go way too far.
Yeah.
You know, the running into the kids smoking crack was way too far. And that was a memory that sat with me. That showed me how bad it could go.
Right.
I wasn't getting the best of grades. I was making some bad decisions. I was going out and partying instead of studying. I was doing a lot wrong. But there was still a lot more downhill to go. And it helped me to see where I was on that path and to try to stay away from that crack line wherever it was, you know, and not cross that because
you didn't want to cross the crack line.
No.
Oh,
no.
My God.
I've heard bad things happen.
Yeah. The fascinating part of this discussion, too, and what is this idea of being in environments that are very structured or sometimes even repressive. I have clients that have tattoos as adults, and they still struggle at times talking to their parents about them. They don't. These are 25 year old young men and women who don't want to talk about this issue with their parents because they still believe that they will be that there's such a level of disapproval from them that they don't want to feel any shame associated with it, and so they kind of keep it a secret, and which sounds just bizarre to me in the long run. But I do understand when you have a culture where the expectations and the belief systems are so strong that gets woven in more than just into a family dynamic. It gets woven into a cultural dynamic as well.
That's why I don't like the judging part. And I do think that the I'm a blame guy. I try not to be too bad when there really is no blame, but I think the judgment on that part is bad. Those parents need to understand that they've already done their best. Their child is an adult, and now they need to treat that child almost like a friend. Your friend doesn't always do what you think they should do, but it's no longer your business. You know, you help them as much as you can. You give them your opinion, but at that point, they're adults.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, we're just going to go right into the topic of free will then, because I couldn't have asked for a better segue there. You're right. It's time to, at a certain point, we need to let go. I can't remember. Who did the thing of that, you know, were the parents of the bow and the children of the arrows? Can't remember who told that story. I don't think it was Skinner, but it was one of the early behavioral psychologists, I believe, that said that, you know, that's the responsibility. You know, the parents are the bow, and then they, you know, have the children, and then they let them go. Wherever they go ends up being up to them based upon environmental influences and other things. But this comes down to this idea of, you know, and I told you I wanted to talk about this, you know, this idea of having free will and free choice. I mean, what does that mean to you? Because that's kind of what I hear you're hinting on a little bit here, is that, you know, we do our best, right, especially with kids, but we also know that they're going to need to make their own choices at some point in life. And this idea, there are people that don't really think of, especially traditional behaviorists, that don't think we really have free will or choice sometimes, you know, that this is more predestined than life is sometimes more predestined. Humans definitely are more predictable than we think.
So I was probably in college before I understood why the church was angry with Sir Isaac Newton. And this goes way back, and there's a little bit of physics in here, but it's not very hard to understand. It's just cause and effect. And what Newton came up with in his very first law was that, you know, everything you do, every action has a reaction. And in fact, I think that's the words he used, mm-hmm. was every action has an equal and opposite reaction.
I think you're right.
And, you know, it makes sense. You see it with the little inertia balls, and you're playing pool. The cue ball hits something, the other balls move. Yeah. I mean, the physics part of it is very clear.
Yeah. Like bowling, right? I love that with bowling. You know, you hit the right couple pins, everything else goes out. Right?
Yeah. And if you hit it like that every time those pins will fall.
That's right.
There's not really any randomness. I mean, given the same situation, which
right.
is impossible in real life, but,
yeah.
but you can get really close, you know, and you can prove that your math is right. Just sometimes a butterfly fluttered his wings and made the wind change
sure.
a little, you know,
which is, you know, this is off the subject, but I'm, you know, which is why really good bowlers are really boring.
Oh yeah. They just roll 300s every, I am way more fun. I'll do a strike and then I'll do a gutter ball.
Yeah, there you go. See, that's energy.
You can wager on me and you'll have fun no matter how well I do, because you know, you'll be surprised.
Okay. This is truly the embracing the bozo-ness of us.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
So anyway, he came up with this cause and effect thing, and he applied it to the physics, but he also extrapolated and said it goes everywhere. In other words, you know, when the bowling ball hits the first pin hits the second hits the fifth. You know, on that last row, that pin's always going to do the same thing based on the ball hitting that very first one.
Yes.
And Newton actually, and the church at the time, which was full of scholars, mm-hmm. extrapolated that out to no free will.
Mm-hmm.
Because whatever happened in the very beginning, you know, whatever hit that first pin, the Big Bang, whatever your belief sure. is, God saying go, everything we've seen in our world eliminates, you know, because cause and effect works, it eliminates all free will. Whatever you do, even though it's electrochemically based, it's still predestined from the beginning. I mean, I don't know what it's going to be. I don't have that computer, and you don't know what it's going to be, even though you're
right.
you.
Right.
But in the guise of Newtonian physics, there is no free will. When
it's a chain reaction.
And
that reaction can be predictable or predicted.
Yeah, whether God created in the beginning or the Big Bang or whatever, you have no free will. Quantum physics came by almost immediately, not immediately, but after, you know, the church was very mad at Sir Isaac Newton, but just kind of let it go for a while. I think they may have excommunicated him. They were upset. But when nuclear physics
came, anytime you mess with a story. Anytime you mess with somebody's story, again, confirmation bias, right? Don't tell me something's wrong with my story or it's not true because, you know, it is my story after all.
Well, up until Einstein, if you believe Newton, you really couldn't believe in God. Or if you did, there's no room for God to do anything else. You know, there's no external input. You know, it leaves the universe alone and when there's no free will. Well, Einstein proved that some of Newton's stuff was wrong. And again, this is at the physics level. Mm-hmm. But it also gave room for randomness. You know, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle and several other things. That gave room a little more for free will and for God. You know, in my world, that's kind of where free will is. I think because we are strange enough, we still have free will. I still like to think I make my choices based on my stimuli.
Uh-huh.
I could be completely wrong, but I think I'm a pretty awesome person. So I'm pretty confident that these choices are mine. But free will is difficult. And not even at the nuclear level. There's other places where you're just not sure, you know.
Well, if we bring this together from the aspect of that everything is based upon cause and effect or a chain reaction. The idea is that this is physics, and that can equally identified or stated that then physics is God, it's spiritual, because there's predestiny in it of some kind. And so instead of seeing science as something separate from God, why can't they be the same thing?
People have postulated that. That's like been the I don't know what class it was, probably philosophy 101 thing.
Philosophy.
Where they just said even given cause and effect and accepting the fact that there's no room for external input in our universe. Our universe mm-hmm. is what it is. Mm-hmm. And so your things are predestined.
Mm-hmm.
You can go back and what was that first thing? What was that first cause or the first effect mm-hmm. that kicked it all off? And if you call that God, most religions, you know, a large percentage of most religions' dogma still works. You know, it's still everything was created by God.
Right.
He knew everything you were going to do. I mean,
right.
whether conscious of it or not,
sure.
if it was a being or not,
yeah.
it still kind of plays out. But most actual religions, the organizations,
right.
not the beliefs, still don't like that because, you know, why give them money if it's predestined?
That's right. Well, but it fits into the whole idea, though. It makes sense if we say, people ask, well, why do such horrible things happen in the world? But it fits into that if it's physics and it's predestined already, that it's not necessarily always a matter of choice because it's actually, we know it's going to happen based upon everything else that has happened before it, then I guess that is what God wants, and that's God working in mysterious ways.
Well, you could say God is the choice, because honestly, there's no room for choice in physics, but yet I think I have choice. I feel that I do. And I mean, this is an ignorant just belief because, but I do think we make choices. I do think that I weigh options and I choose what to do, and I'm not consistent. And, you know, that randomness,
mm-hmm.
you know, maybe that's room for divinity in the world of physics.
Sure. Well, it's almost as if the forces exist. I guess we choose how we respond to those forces. And this, I think, is what, even when we're talking about things like addictions in life, or we're talking about how we respond to the world around us, and I mean, you probably know this already because you read the book and helped edit it, that this idea that we always have a choice, that everything's pretty much predestined in a way around us as far as the laws of physics go. But the truth of the matter is we have a choice whether we bowl the bowling ball, right? You could stand there and not do anything and nothing would change. It would stay exactly the way it is. Or I can pick up the bowling ball and throw it down the alley. Now, my chances of getting a gutter ball may be equal to yours. I don't know. But, I'm not a great bowler either, but I have a good time. But if I don't take responsibility and say that I have the ability to choose how I play based upon, where I've been in the past, then I'm not taking accountability and responsibility for, what I bring to the game, so to speak, the game.
Well, plus we don't always take the easiest path, right?
Right.
We would be taking the easiest path, I think, if we weren't making a choice. Why get up off the couch to go bowling? That's a lot of effort. I mean, right at this moment, sure, I'd like to bowl. I don't want to go bowling. That's a lot of effort to go get in the car.
Well, we'd have to stop this, too. I don't want to choose to do that right now.
But I guess my point is, why would a human ever do anything more difficult than an easier choice if we weren't making our choices ourselves?
Oh, and right on. So that's the whole premise behind when people say they choose to do something different or they're ready for changes, the idea of continuing to do an old behavior, whether it be, substances, sex, money, food, work, whatever the obsessive compulsive nature of that behavior is, until the choice to change it becomes less painful, they will continue doing the same thing over and over again, right? So the idea that pain being somewhat of a motivator for change or lack of motivation for change, if one decides to stay doing the same behavior, acting out in the same way they do, making the same kind of choices, that won't change until there's something that's less painful for them or easier to. So for some reason, all of a sudden, it's easier to get up off the couch and go bowling than to just sit here and not do that.
True.
Yeah.
But that doesn't cover the case of true altruism. The guy running into to a burning house to save a stranger's child. I mean, there's no reason to do that.
Exactly. So then.
And it happens.
But then that's choice.
That's why I'm saying. That's why I think part of free will is sometimes doing something that's not the easiest choice.
Perfect.
Because your example of being on the couch, well, you made that become the easiest choice.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the person was getting so overweight, they were having trouble getting out of the couch, mm-hmm. and they knew that it was going to be way worse if they didn't change their behavior now.
Sure.
But that still doesn't cover altruism. Yeah. And altruism exists, so I think choice exists. And I think we make them.
I think I agree with you. Actually, I wouldn't even say think. I do agree with you. Yeah, that's a great example for why we have free will and choice. Because we can choose to be altruistic. And without a confirmation bias, too. So the biases go aside, too. Because if I'm going to run in to a burning house or I'm going to jump into a lake and save somebody in cold, freezing water or something like that, that's definitely a choice. I mean, people do that not just to save another person. They do it to save animals. Mm-hmm. And that sounds terrible. Actually, I caught myself. Sorry. Yeah. Because animals are species and loving creatures, too. So.
Well, some of them are jerks. Fire ant, I'll just step on that guy. And he doesn't need to prove to me that particular ant was a good guy. No, he's going to suffer because of the rest of his species. So I judge them.
I see. Okay. All right.
And wasps. I don't deal with wasps.
Yeah, wasps are fascinating, aren't they? Yeah.
Bees I don't mind, but I'll run.
Yeah.
I used to say I'll run like a girl from a wasp,
mm-hmm.
but I am such a poor athlete. There are so many girls that are much better athletes than me, but I will run away screaming from a wasp. Yeah. I don't like wasps.
So mid-teens, I'm going to guess, living in Essex, Connecticut, and I was cutting up some trees on my brother's property. For clearing out a certain area. And I remember I was cutting through them with a chainsaw, and I didn't know it, accidentally, I guess. if there's an accident, cut through the middle of a wasp nest, a very, very large one. And all of a sudden, there were hundreds of wasps just everywhere. And I just started running back to the house. I just dropped the chainsaw and running back to the house. And I'm getting stung. I mean, they're coming to my back on my back. And I just had a T-shirt on. I remember taking the T-shirt off and throwing it down and looking at it and going, it was just like covered. I mean, I don't know how many there were. I probably got stung 50, 60 times.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you get sick? That could be.
I didn't. In fact, I mean, I got sick. I definitely had a reaction to it, but I mean, it didn't have any really physiological problems except for some nausea and, you know, a headache and things like that, but mostly went away. And since then, I've been stung by wasps, I hardly feel anything. It's been strange. I don't know what the cause and effect on that is, but it's been strange.
I have never had a traumatic wasp experience like that. I've been stung about 3 times.
Uh-huh.
And every time I get stung now, I'm so ashamed at how much fear I have over these creatures. Uh-huh. That because the sting doesn't hurt. I mean, it hurts, but it doesn't hurt that bad. It doesn't hurt even worth a tiny squeal and running away a little bit. I mean, for hundreds of wasps, yes. You sprint.
It's interesting the things that change our pain tolerance. Because I remember after that, my pain tolerance went way up. It's like things that I thought before really hurt didn't have the same experience from physical pain the same way. Anyway,
I find it interesting that I don't get burned anymore. I don't even blister much at all. Like I'll touch something hot and it'd be something that would burn me years ago. Now it hurts for a half hour and no blister.
You're talking about your fingers?
Yeah.
Well, I wonder if that has something to do with your bass playing.
Could be. Although I get blisters playing bass, just not touching hot things.
Well, you're probably, because you're a hot bass player. I just had to say it. All right. Opiates of the masses. What are your thoughts today, in today's world? I mean, let's sort of leave the theological dogma off the table for just this discussion. Because traditionally, I mean, if we go back to Marx, right? Or was it? Yeah. They talked about opiate being religion being the opiate of the masses. But
I was wondering where you were going with that, because I didn't realize there was any opiates in religions or drugs, really, that...
All religions have some form of it, of a drug in it. And it may not be always a narcotic or an illicit type drug, you know, but I mean, you think of ceremonies where, especially like Native American ceremonies. So this, and that, when I say Native American, I should probably just say indigenous tribal cultures all over the world have been using hallucinogens since...
And sweat lodges for
thousands of years, and using it as a spiritual experience. So, and still do today, But when I say opiate of the masses, I'm thinking that it's something that people just consume, and it doesn't have to be physical consumption. Though one of the things that is probably the opiate of the masses in today's world, especially here in Utah, sugar. As far as a substance goes, but when you look around the world today and you kind of see things, whether from a geopolitical point of view or whatever, what do you think the opiates of the masses are nowadays?
Well, I mean, right now we have this weird drive toward, I'm trying to think of a word other than fascism because I don't want to be judgy, but, patriotism.
Okay.
You know, just, I mean, extreme amounts of unjustified, in my mind, patriotism and love for yourself for reasons that you shouldn't love yourself. You know, it's like all the racism in the world coming to light has pushed all this white pride that is really not justified. You know?
Yes.
And it seems right now that just the polarizing arguments seem to be the opioid of the masses, and I can't stand it. It I mean, I'm involved. I can't keep my mouth shut when I have serious self-control issues when someone in front of me says something that I perceive to be stupid. I generally respond and generally regret it, but I mean, I don't regret it because I lose. I regret it because I've interfered with someone's life for no reason. Didn't make anything better, just made them hate me.
You kick somebody in the arse.
Yeah, exactly. And they didn't leave
normally
with
verbally is what we're talking about.
Well, yeah, and they didn't leave with a changed mind or a renewed respect for whatever my opinion was. Right. They just got kicked in the...
I think I remember you sharing this, that this is one of those dynamics. And there's obviously the political influences, but this idea of any time we get into a place of entitlement that's based upon culture, race, creed, gender, things pretty quickly begin to fall apart. And when I say fall apart, what I'm saying is any type of inclusion and any type of tolerance or the ability to embrace diversity begins to crumble, deteriorates, and then so does the ability to practice empathy and being able to view life through someone else's shoes. I agree with you, definitely. This is a strong indicator of You said the word fascism and said that you don't know how accurate that is. And that may not be. But definitely nationalism or at least discrimination and bigotry grow out of this.
Well, and it makes it very difficult to have that conversation because, you know, when you have something like the Charlotte issue with the Nazis protesting the pulling down of the statues, which some could consider to be historical monuments as well. I mean, there was definitely some room for intelligent discussion. But as soon as the swastikas came out, that's all anybody could focus on. As soon as there was racism, you can't have an intelligent discussion when there's that turd sitting in the room. You know, you got to get rid of the turd first. And I think that's what's really been killing discussion. I finally had a reasonable Facebook discussion on a post after like a year and a half of just people yelling at each other and calling racists. But I had to physically get in and say, no, what you said wasn't fair. First, you're attacking him. Second, it's just not true. You can't pile up all these half-truths and say, therefore, everything's true. It's not. But that was one discussion out of hundreds. And we're not talking anymore as a people because there's always that turd in the room that's preventing the conversation. I don't want to discuss whether a monument is historically accurate or not when a guy's wearing a swastika. Because obviously he's not there because of historical accuracy of the Civil War. He's there to promote some kind of racist agenda. I mean, hence the swastika.
Right.
And I mean, that's an extreme example, but it still happens at the smaller things too. It's difficult to discuss whether or not a particular politician should or should not have done, you know, something more for a decision, say, something in his ballywick, because there's five cases against him for abusing women or something like that.
Sure.
It's become so awful, it's difficult to discuss the points where there is common ground. Because I don't have any common ground discussing, you know, racism or misogyny or anything else. And that's what everything seems to be boiling down to, are these taboo subjects almost.
Well, let's just move on to another one. Because today is March 24th, and it is the March for Peace Day, which is led by teenagers. I mean, they're sort of the voice, or they're up front. They're, I guess, the way to say that. It's being supported, though, by groups and advocates on the subject of gun control. And it's almost as if we have, you know, talk about a culture, and I mean, I know they started talking about, well, what are the new opiates of the masses? And I think there's one of them here. It's not guns, per se. But it's this idea that what guns represent as far as control goes. This idea of feeling that I have something I can hold that I can address the deep-seated fear in my life that I'm not okay or safe in the world. This idea that something's out there against me, which again, when we talk about you know, any form of discrimination in life and any type of bigotry or bias, that's what comes out of this, is that I'm not okay. Something's wrong with me. So I focus on the problem, or I focus on the differences. And so here we are today. This national movement is happening right in real time, right now. And it's being led by young people that have sort of grabbed onto a voice here of something that, I didn't grow up with. I mean, I'm assuming you didn't grow up with shootings at your school, but I could be wrong. I mean, I had someone bring a gun I went to Valley Regional High in, I think it was Deep River, Connecticut, and I was the only time, actually, you know, it's the only public school I went to, I think. But I can remember someone had a gun in school one day, and, you know, that was kind of handled and moved over, but we never had anyone come in and shoot up a school because, of course, we didn't have assault weapons back then either. So, I mean, times have changed.
Well, kind of, right? I mean, so I did grow up with shotguns in the trucks in the parking lot, nobody caring.
Okay.
You know, shooting a tree.
You're right. There were hunters and sportsmen that I went to school with that did have, they did have gun racks. That is true.
And, I mean, it was a tool.
Yeah.
Particularly a shotgun or a rifle was a hunting tool.
Yeah.
They were fun. It's fun to go shoot, but it's also expensive. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, honestly, kids would rather shoot a BB gun just because we could afford to buy BBs. Mm-hmm. You know, and ammunition's expensive. And, you know, I grew up in a city. Even though people did have things in their cars, you couldn't discharge a gun in the city, and we knew that was a serious offense,
right.
You know.
Yeah.
So, but the assault rifle thing, I have to say, I understand most of the sides.
Mm-hmm.
Not the NRA side. You know, that goes to the whole lobbying and oligarchy. Those are my hot buttons. I think the NRA is the problem here. But the other issue is, these guns have gotten way more powerful, but not in a way you could actually define. You know, the going hunting as a kid, where eventually we're just shooting at anything that moved, because in West Texas, not much moves, and it's me and another 15-year-old with a shotgun. So, you know, a squirrel, turtle, anything after you've been hiking for 3 hours looking for a turkey, you're going to shoot at. You miss because, you know, you're an idiot 15-year-old, but that's kind of
what... As long as you don't shoot somebody your foot off, you're probably okay, I'm going to guess, right?
But this was a Sears, you know, probably 1970s, 1960s gas-action shotgun. Technically semi-automatic. Mm-hmm. You pull the trigger, it'll chamber another round, mm-hmm. you know, at least one in three times. You know, it wasn't the best weapon. But
that's you to say it's semi-automatic is probably a little bit of a stretch, but yes.
But no,
I know what you're saying.
And actually, that particular one, a gas action shotgun, is 100% the same mechanism in every, not only semi-automatic, but automatic weapon. They still capture that gas pressure to chamber the next round, and whether or not one goes
yes,
right
I
off.
I know what you're talking about, yeah.
It is kind of the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, where I like to break the mold and get particular is a revolver is technically semi-automatic. Every time you pull the trigger, a round goes off. So
until you're out.
Until you're out, yeah. And it's much smaller magazine size.
Yeah.
But when it comes to, like, an assault rifle versus a hunting rifle, mm-hmm. there's not a lot really to distinguish it. I mean, obviously it looks like an assault rifle, but that's just an appearance. If you look at an AK that someone's carrying in the Middle East, it looks like a deer rifle with a magazine.
True.
And if it doesn't have the magazine in it, it just looks like a deer rifle. It's wooden, it's pointed, it doesn't look fancy.
True.
You know. And I think I know with my wife, that's a lot of the problem. My wife is very angry that all these children are dying, and she blames it on automatic weapons. And, well, first off, they're not fully automatic. That's illegal.
That's true.
They do fire very quickly, and maybe firing rate is something we can use to distinguish an assault rifle mm-hmm. for something else, maybe magazine size. But I do side a little bit with the gun manufacturers and the legislators that it's extremely difficult to define what an assault rifle is
true.
So that you can legislate against them. Now, that being said, I am completely for any kind of checks or regulations. I've got a couple of weapons. I fired a lot of assault rifles. Mm-hmm. I enjoy them. It's great fun. you know, at a range, not at a school. But, you know, I apologize. I do get dark and irreverent way too often, but I would happily take my shotgun in and, you know, have them, you know, log the serial number and, sure. you know, we all buy and sell cars. Mm-hmm. Even when we do it illegally, we still have that bill of sale. And by illegally, I mean charging a dollar for a car to avoid taxes, which everybody does. Even when you do that, you still have the bill of sale. You still have to file the registration. You still have proof that your car with this VIN number went to someone else. I don't have a problem in oversight like that.
Yeah.
And as far as the Second Amendment goes, I'm sorry. It makes no sense today. Yeah. It just doesn't. Yeah. I mean, I cannot protect myself from the government. Mm-hmm. They have way bigger weapons than I do.
That's true.
I'm not allowed to have a nuke or a machine gun or a Apache or anything else.
That
so,
would,
yeah, so I cannot protect myself from an abusive government. Mm-hmm. And with or without an AK, that doesn't change. So I honestly don't have any love for the Second Amendment. It kind of needs to be repealed.
Yeah.
Or rewritten into something that makes sense today.
Maybe updated or something. Yeah. You know, I'm sure the idea behind it, I mean, I know we started on this with the idea of what are the opiates of the masses, but that kind of almost religiosity that happens with a topic like this becomes overpowering in people's lives. And it's fostered or fueled or fed by fear and anxiety and control and a sense of what we use that creates power or and maybe it's much simpler than this for some people, but it's the idea that what I believe is going to keep me safe at night in some weird way. I mean, everyone has that, you know. It for some it may be, you know, what they put in their pipe. You know, for another person, you know, it may be, you know, how many miles they ran that day. For another person, it may be, you know, what's stored in the closet or under the bed, you know, as far as a weapon goes. And I guess, you know, I believe everyone has the right to choose that, what that is for them. But how it's controlled and regulated obviously needs to be looked at in a way, and I think you and I are probably on the same opinion there, that we need to have better systems in place for that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, I think it's really dumb to look at cities like Detroit or Chicago or New York with strict laws, and they still have, you know, issues with gun control, because I've driven to all of those cities, and I didn't pass a single checkpoint that was going to take away my gun. So, I mean, because a city has rules doesn't mean you can't go to the next city right. and buy what you want.
Yeah.
You know, the same way I'm sure all the borders of Colorado are way greener than the cities further away, because there's not that checkpoint making right. sure that, you know, something that's legal in one place is kept there.
Yeah. Well, not for that. That, you know, under the notion that you know, they're not going to do a, you know, a search to find out if you have, you know, cannabis of some form and, you know, you're leaving the state with it. I mean, that's unrealistic. But we do have that for whether people are drinking and driving. You know, they're...
Well, we have spot checks.
Spot checks,
yeah. Rarely have... But we don't have a border.
No.
And that's what I'm saying. If you have an open border and something is illegal on one side, not on the other, mm-hmm. it's going to be on both sides. So because a city or a state has very strict gun laws... Uh-huh. means nothing, because the next state doesn't, and right. it's not very hard to drive for a few hours.
It's true. In Chicago especially, I mean, it's a good example, because it's, you know, it's got a number of other metropolitan areas around it, and definitely that's, you know, you don't, and I don't know what half a dozen highways that are coming into that region. So
that's why I like to compare our issues with the two extreme countries that got rid of guns, which would be the UK and Australia.
Yeah.
And they have very good success stories, but I know
Japan, or the Japan never have them, because they have very strict gun control too.
I don't think they had a lot. I don't know though. I don't know. But I know Australia is the most like us. They're mm-hmm. very independent, very rebellious. You know, they're another you know, failed colony or penal colony, but
a failed penal colony, yes, sure.
Yeah. But you know, it's another turd that the UK left around. So it's a very similar, you know, type of people, I think, than us. And I think that's a really good correlation of the issue they had and how they made it go away. Mm-hmm. Plus, I haven't looked into a great deal of their laws, but I assume you can still hunt without issue because they're, you know, pretty much every animal there is going to kill you. You need to shoot some of them. But the other one is Canada. So Canada actually has pretty loose gun regulation, but doesn't have the same issues we do. So I think that'd be a closer point to look at. I am not a fan normally of Michael Moore's films, but I was very impressed with Bowling for Columbine.
Yeah, it was well done, yes.
I mean, the fact that he didn't come up with an answer and that his assumptions, which were wrong, and I grew up a video gamer. I know about all the video game studies, and I would love to say it's Doom's fault, but it's simply not. Study after study has proven it's not.
I agree.
The fact our current administration can't remember 10 years ago and are looking at video games again, I think it's just...
Current administration? What are you talking about? People can't barely remember 10 years ago.
Yeah, but you'd think the people who were making the laws there... I mean, people don't leave Congress, really. They look how old they are. They stay there forever. That's true. They should remember.
2008, we had a financial crisis, and people have forgotten.
I honestly don't think they have. I think there's just a little too much evil up there. There's too much greed and money. I think the NRA
is why we had a financial crisis.
Yes. And now we're ready to have another one because you can make a lot of greedy money if you ignore those rules.
Yeah.
And the NRA with the gun laws, I mean, we have people tugging heartstrings and manipulating people for greed, mm-hmm. and that's causing a lot of our problems.
Sure. So what do you, I started off talking about, you know, what today kind of represents, and I know we've been bouncing around the subject, but how do you feel personally about having, the teenagers and adolescents sort of having a voice and being able to express that and being able to take on a topic like this? I mean, this isn't the first time something like this has happened. It's just that right now it seems that whatever it is, it seems to be more palatable to hear this from an adolescent, some of this messaging. It resonates in a different way.
Well, I think because the adolescents have had a gun pointed at them.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's why they have this unique perspective where they can shut up the talking points that are supplied by, you know, the people for less gun control. However, I think I counted my negatives and that was right. But like the NRA talking points don't make any sense when a child can say an assault rifle was pointed at me in my school. How is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the only reason they're having any kind of success. It's very difficult to fight that money. And honestly, that's what it is. Nobody thinks assault rifles are necessary. I enjoy them. Right. I've shot them. If I had a collection of them, I would be resistant to having my toys taken away.
Yeah.
But that's what it would be. It would be taking away my toys. If I enjoy shooting at trees or targets or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, it's just losing a toy. At the same time, I think if we're more careful and do registration and background checks and stuff like that, we can avoid taking away toys, which I think is the only major negative that people would say, not politicians.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the stuff, like I said, just doesn't, I don't care if you have the right to have that weapon. I don't want it next door to me, maybe.
Sure.
You know, or I don't think you should have it.
Well, or not,
you know, no. You in particular.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen you get really mad at a grocery store. Maybe, I mean, not you, Paul, but maybe
well,
the person
let's say
I'm talking
it was me,
to.
Because that'll be fun. Yeah, right. Right. So, anger control issues or an inability to be able to deal with or emotionally regulate. And then there's a whole, I mean, we talk. Obviously, there's a mental health issue that needs to be addressed surrounding all of this. And I know in my field that this is not uncommon to look and think about you know, the idea of people suffering emotionally and mentally in their lives, and the only way they feel they can get some resolution on that is to hurt other people. I mean, I use this term, hurt people hurt people. And the idea behind that is that, those of us that go through an experience of great loss or grief or abandonment in our lives, or maybe never even have any healthy attachments in one form or another, don't feel often connected, and then which often leads to isolation. I mean, we notice this as a very common factor with people that struggle with drugs and alcohol. It's a very common thing that don't understand that that moderation is something that can be done. But why don't they feel like they have a choice to do that? Why does the isolation become such a big thing? And so I think it kind of leads into this same dynamic, is that, how do we talk about these kinds of issues, and how do we deal with these kinds of issues in life? A lot of people just struggle simply with being vulnerable. You know, they don't know how to it not come off as a sign of weakness, especially men. There just aren't that many women going in and shooting up places. I'm not just saying that women don't get angry. I mean, of course they do, but and so it's not just gender based, but the mental health issues surrounding this seem, on some ways, to be somewhat predictable.
Oh, and it's not only just males. It's white males.
Yeah.
And it's, I wouldn't say affluent, but comfortable. You know, so economically stable, normal white males are the main demographic for this. And I don't disagree with the NRA when they say it's a mental health issue. It absolutely is. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean we need less access to guns. While they're right, that I still don't agree with their conclusion.
Yes.
From their point.
Okay.
But, I mean, think about it. When we were – or even on TV, you go and hit a heavy bag. You do stuff. Especially young white males are angry. Mm-hmm. They get angry, and we have to – I mean, as a older white male, I had issues. I still have anger issues. Uh-huh. I get angry a lot, and it's difficult to deal with. Mm-hmm. And when I was a kid, I liked science. I liked chemistry. I built bombs because it was, I mean, little things, but never would I ever want
to say, David.
I would never want to hurt anyone.
Yeah.
I mean, I was mainly concerned with hurting myself. But I would do fun little things, because watching things burn and blow up is, I mean, that's adolescent crack right there.
Yeah.
That's just fun stuff. Blowing up a stump. My favorite was, I filled a balloon with hydrogen that I made.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was very happy to have, done both actions. And then tied a string to it, and it was lighter than air. So mm-hmm. I was also happy that I had enough I could float a balloon.
Uh-huh.
And of course, I lit the string and let it go up and had a nice little boom up in the sea. I mean, you could really have some fun, but that's like the fun you could have with a gun that's not. It's dangerous, but there's no evil. There may not be any malice associated with the firearm itself or the incendiary device or anything else. It's then, why was it created, and what are you going to use it for?
Yeah.
And I think the problem is twofold. It is the white male anger and angst combined with the ability to get these weapons that allow you to do way too much damage to way too many people, and I bet 90% of the reason they're doing it is just for attention, because mm-hmm. they want help.
Well, yeah, it definitely there's a cry for help in this, and I think there's also this piece of not having certain life skills to be able to cope with some basic aspects to being a human being in the 21st century. They're just we just are not giving and promoting healthy coping mechanisms and tools quite often in life. All right. So, though we didn't quite come to a conclusion of what the opiates of the masses were in that discussion, we're rambling through a number of topics. Let's shift over a little bit and talk a little bit about the recovery piece that you've been going through in your family. This has been an interesting time for you. You've dealt with your wife's recovery from chemo and radiation, right?
Okay. Well, mainly cancer.
Cancer.
You got to start from the first. That's the scary part.
Okay. And I know you kind of said, well, I did. Well, I don't want to say I know, because I don't know. I mean, I've experienced the things you've shared with me, and shared with a lot of people what this has been like. But I also know that how much you've kind of tried to keep this in such a way. I don't remember the words you used to describe it, but I mean, you kind of looked at it from a physics, almost a physics point of view at times.
And, oh yeah, I had to do it mathematically.
Yeah, that's what you said. Yeah,
which is how they do cancer treatment. But so my normal coping mechanism, mm-hmm. just in life, mm-hmm. is I need to be prepared for any situation. Mm-hmm. So because of that, I usually focus on the absolute worst thing that could happen. And my wife can't do this. This drives her crazy, but this makes me comfortable. It actually relaxes uh-huh. me. So a good example, when we moved from Georgia to here, the housing market was really low. And we could not sell our house. So we moved here, and Tammy said, well, what should we do? I said, well, we should buy a house here. She said, but what if the other forecloses? I said, exactly. Then we already have a house here. We're not forced to stay in an apartment for 7 years. Uh-huh. You know, we have a foreclosure on our record, but we own a house again.
Yeah.
So that's what we did. It ended up being fine, but I had to focus on a foreclosure. I had to focus on the worst possible thing and be very comfortable with handling that. With cancer, I simply couldn't do it. I could not focus on the possibility of Tammy dying. I couldn't come to terms with that. I couldn't think about it. Mm-hmm. So instead, I just had to cope with the disease and with learning way too much about cancer. And by truly understanding what the numbers meant, you know, if you do this, it's a 88% chance of survival. And what does survival really mean in these uh-huh. numbers? And so, yeah, I've had to focus on the statistics because I like the number 88%. I don't like thinking about, you know, that the remaining 12% is over 1 in 10. Mm-hmm. You know, I couldn't do that, but 88 sounds great. That's B+. That's a good grade.
Yeah, man, almost an A-, you know. I mean, it's really close.
Yeah, that's good things. Yeah. And that every treatment, you know, kind of... And with cancer, that's honestly how you have to do it, I think. Especially if you want to be accurate, because... Mm-hmm. That's all they do. All they can do is studies. It's such a strange disease and such a difficult one to fight, you know, to be able to kill a cancer cell without killing the Tammy cell, you know, the human cell.
Right.
It's tough. And so everything is statistics. You know, if you do a mastectomy versus a lumpectomy, the statistics change, but not a lot. And then they've done all these studies, but they haven't done everything. So I can't say that for my, you know, 28-year-old wife, how exactly, you know, the numbers compare to her, uh-huh. because they haven't narrowed them down like that. So it is really uh-huh. difficult. But what I do like is that my wife is relatively young. She's very strong. Uh-huh. She's not sickly or anything. Mm-hmm. And most of their numbers are across the board. So I love the fact that of those 12% that are not having the best time, you right. know, after their cancer treatment.
Yes.
I like thinking they're probably all older, weak. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's not too far from the truth.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure there are some cases where young people have issues too, and strong people have issues. But so I've had to focus on the numbers to cope. I cannot address the thought of losing her.
Yeah.
And I don't have to.
No, you don't have to. And maybe, and so the idea when I use the word recovery in this, and it's about what that healing process looks like as a family is as going through something like this, because there are unknowns. And I mean, the idea that you say, you know, you look at the worst case scenario and you kind of work off of that, and that it helps to approach this mathematically, creates maybe some safety there. Too.
Oh yeah, it's right? My coping mechanism.
Yeah, that's
my personal.
That's a great coping. I mean, I won't say great. That's a coping mechanism actually that for the way you sort of approach life and the way you look at life, you know, allows you to, you know, maintain your sanity, if you mm-hmm. will, in such a way that you are able to, you know, emote and share your feelings. And I've seen you go through a menagerie of different things during this time, and you've been pretty vulnerable with it. So I'm saying that not to embarrass you in any way or say that this is not something that you know, that you've struggled with, you know, overly in any way, but just more of the opposite of your willingness to show up and just sort of allow, you've allowed so many people in too. And this is, again, when we talk about all kinds of struggles that people have emotionally and mentally, the more they can allow people in and not isolate really helps, I think, with that healing process. So I'm saying this because I'm actually, you know, complimenting you is what I'm getting to here, because that the idea of watching you embrace your community, your friends, your family, all the people that showed up, which really shows the power to healing to me and to creating those kind of connections in life where we're not going through something like this alone, even though, yes, you know, you're in the middle of it, in the core of it, but you surrounded yourself with these communities that, you know, that want to show up, you know.
In a limited sense, though. So I will have to say the one thing I did have to do is keep Tammy off the internet. And only because, you know, as much as I love the numbers that I know are statistically relevant, when you go on to a site or a page or a Facebook group or whatever with cancer, even cancer survivors, you're mainly going to hear when they're upset, when they need to get something off their chest, when they're venting, and it's generally going to be bad news. And it, you know, for Tammy, it was giving her this unrealistic view that everybody dies or gets really sick or has a terrible time. And, you know, they're very careful when they do studies and when they do, you know, medical things to be sure that they've captured, you know, all the people, that their group is good, that they have a good control group, that their numbers
are possible. Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. But when you're looking at a subset of a group, you know, and this is the people who have had or know somebody with cancer who also want to post online, it's generally the angry people.
Yeah.
It's the people that need to vent. And that's looking at them. 90% of all people die from cancer, have terrible time with the treatments, and it's worse than death, you know, and that, I know you mentioned community, and I know you were talking about our friends and family, but I had to say I did have to draw a line at the strangers because it was just too much. And like I said, it looked like everybody was going to die, and she just was not having a good time with it.
Yeah, no, and I agree that you have the boundaries are really important in this kind of thing, and I want to go back because you said something about the people that struggle, the people that have become angry or feel victimized in some way by this, and that's, you know, we definitely have talked about the victim narrative a bit, but that can come out of a situation like this where, you know, and you know, we blame, you know, the environment, or we blame God, or, you know, we blame a cell phone, or do you know what I'm saying? Oh,
I'm like that. If it's not my fault, I get extra angry and I want to blame people. Yeah. And it's not a good habit. I'm not proud of it, but I do that. I'll, you know, who left this door open? Well, obviously I can narrow it down to the three other people in the house that aren't me, you know, and right. Even asking that question is not a good character trait for me.
it's like asking the question we were talking about this with a couple colleagues the other day. Is you're asking somebody what's wrong, and they go, "Well, what's wrong with that?" And I go, "Well, because you're assuming that something's wrong when you ask somebody what's wrong."
True.
I kind of went, well, that does make sense. Okay, so am I setting up a context in which that person needs to reply to something that could possibly be wrong in their life, even though there may not be anything wrong? And so it's actually, as the interpreter of what's going on, I'm defining that something's wrong. So under the guise of asking a question a certain way, nothing's wrong. Nothing's wrong. All right. Are you okay to move on?
Sure.
Okay. What brings you joy?
You know, that changes constantly. But I have to say, in the last 3 months, it's been snowboarding on Friday nights. So we have night skiing here, and they always have a cheap night in the week. And when I first moved here, I started doing it as a bonding experience for my team at work. We'd go night skiing. We'd try to leave around 4, and like 5 to 7, 5 to 8, ski a little bit, then have dinner. The conditions are terrible. It's cold. Sometimes it's really nice, but usually it's not about, you know, the great conditions or anything. But it was just okay. Somehow moving it to Friday night, and this is just because the coupon happens to work on a Friday night this particular season. This is nothing like in general. But doing it on a Friday night just makes it more fun. It's a night out with the guys or girls or whoever shows up.
Right.
You know, going to the bar at the resort and having a beer afterward and chatting about, you know, the you falling down or whatever is the highlight of it. And I absolutely love it. It's been, for like the past 2 months, my favorite thing. But it changes all the time, you know. So usually going to Mexico or something like that. Uh-huh. Even though I'm a ginger, I love being in the water. So it means I have to have a snorkel all day long. But, you know, I love doing fun, active-ish things. Yeah. I mean, I'm not the best athlete or anything. I'm always out of shape. But I cannot stand just watching TV for the sake of watching TV. Even though I do it too much, I generally like to do something.
Okay.
And it's usually an active thing that makes me happy.
Well, and, we play in a band together. So I make an assumption, too, playing music brings you joy. But I thought about that. I said, well, yeah, it does bring me joy, too. It's a way I, you know, reach out and connect, definitely, through music. But I also, you know, when I take myself too seriously with it, which I do with just about everything sometimes, I realize it becomes frustrating because I create expectations. And that's the big downfall. But what about music?
Actually, with music and with active things, I am not very athletic. Uh-huh. I am really uncoordinated. I cannot throw or hit or anything a ball the same way twice. So I learn everything very slowly. And because of that, I've learned to just, it's an old military term, but I love it. It's embrace the suck.
Embrace the suck. I know the term too. Yeah.
And I like that because that's, if you can do that, if being a crappy snowboarder, I can still have fun doing a little thing I didn't do before on the snowboard. Uh-huh. I have a great day. However, if I spend the whole day trying to just get a little better and making very slight progress, I'll have a really crappy day. So similarly on the bass, I've stopped trying to play perfectly. I've stopped trying to look up the tab. I try to not even know what song we're on and just follow. But then whenever I nail it, whenever I do something nice, that nailing it is so much more important to me than something I'd worked on really hard because it just came to me.
Yeah.
And I have more fun moments, so.
Do you notice that? I mean, this is about this, the band more than anything, but like we were joking last week about, we played without a drummer, right? And then, you know, we go, just, you know, the difference when you have a drummer there, right? How much more joy there is that comes from that, because it's like this whole group environment experience. And I always have fun. Regardless, I mean, for the most part, it's just an enjoyment experience. But there's something about when enough of us get together that we can kind of fill the sound, that it really is a lot more fun, too.
It really is.
Yeah.
And like, I've been on stage a few times, and that's rarely fun. I usually don't enjoy performing. Even if I nail it, I'll be judging myself about something I did wrong, you know. But just playing, I love. I mean, I've had bands named No Aspirations and stuff like that, because that's the thing. It's like, yeah, I would get up and play on stage, but I certainly don't need to, and I have no aspirations to. It's just, let's have some fun and play. If somebody wants to hear it, sure, they can listen. We'll go get on a stage, but why work too hard?
Why work too hard? Okay, where's your zen spot? Where's you find that zen zone in life?
Usually the woods.
The woods, okay.
You know, I used to do I know it always goes back to snowboarding, but I enjoy the mountains a lot in the winter.
Yeah.
And a couple of years ago when I was in better shape, I would go to one of the resorts and hike up before the resort opened and just walk all the way up the mountain and do one run down. And I'm sure everyone's thinking, oh, that sounds awesome. That's got to be so worth it. It never is. Or very rarely ever. I mean, I'm fat and slow. I'm talking an hour and a half to hike up 1,000 feet, maybe a 1 mile, but 1,000 feet climb. And on a snowboard, I can get down that in 2 minutes. I mean, it's simply not worth it. But that's not what I'm not climbing instead of snowboarding. I'm climbing instead of getting on a treadmill.
Right.
And I have had some I've had this day several times, but it's not common. It just, but when it happens, it's amazing. Uh-huh. So before the sun comes up, everything's a little black. And with the snow on the ground, you could see it. It reflects the starlight, everything.
Right,
so,
yeah.
You know, the black turns into the white shadows. So, I mean, I have a little light. I can make, you know, I can see enough to get up. But then that turns to gray. And then the particular mountain I climb, one of the peaks hits the sun first. And the sun rises behind me.
Uh-huh.
So it hits this peak before it touches anything on the ground.
Uh-huh.
And so the moment it touches the peak, it's bright gold. And everything goes from gray to color, like in a moment's
just
notice.
Instantly, yes.
And just that whole thing, just the climbing up. And then that starts looking like a holy grail as the peak gets brighter and brighter. I mean, it's full sunlight and it's been dark. So it's just almost blinding for a while. And this is just over, you know, a half hour or 45 minutes as the sun rises. Just the colors constantly change. The landscape constantly changes. I'm usually listening to some book on tape or something, you know, just I found that an interesting pulp fiction will make me want to finish the chapter. So like the cheesiest, but, you know, page turner, Harry Potter, Stephen King's great, stuff like that. I did try some deep books, you know, I listened to Sun Tzu's Art of War. Not recommended for anything. I mean, you just start ignoring it.
Talk about zoning out.
Yeah. But those, that moment I really like. Just that climb when it's beautiful. And then, you know, once or twice it's been a really good run down. But usually it's just that climb, watching the sun come up and wondering why no one else is there. Why wouldn't the entire city want to see this?
Yeah, right. Exactly. That's a beautiful Zen zone. That's a beautiful
It's been
zen
a couple
spot.
Of years. I mean, I need to get back up there.
All right. We've done quite a bit about God and faith in the beginning. But let's talk about the playlist for your life celebration, or what would represent, what are a couple songs that you think would represent you in your life?
So you mentioned it kind of earlier. And I tried to think of something, but this is a really difficult one for me because I listen to music strangely. It's sometimes lyrics. It's sometimes a riff. Mm-hmm. It's sometimes, you know, one of the Zenist songs I really like is Suzanne Vega's Tom's Diner. I just love the do-to-dos. I don't care what it's about. I don't care. I see a Norman Rockwell, you know, painting of a diner in New York. And actually, I see the album cover, which is pretty much a Norman Rockwell.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Yeah, I see that, and just the do-to-do just makes me smile. I don't know why. You know, the music you love for your podcast, the What If God Was One of Us, that was one that just makes me smile. And that's the words, because to me, that's so deep. Yeah. What if he was?
Yeah, what if he was?
You know, there's all kinds of jokes right now on, you know, what if Jesus were to come back today, you know, given how screwed up we are as a country right now. And it's that same kind of thing as what if God were one of us? What if he really was? What if he was here now? Would you be embarrassed? Would you not? You know, as a society, I would. Personally, yeah, I do some things I'd be a little ashamed of. We all do.
Yeah.
Nothing major. I'm pretty happy with, you know.
That's a really good point. I like it. So I'm gonna think that. That if Jesus did come back, that he would probably want us to sing that song, that's for sure.
Yeah, really sing it. We'd have to be re-indoctrinated.
Exactly. All right. We're going to end here. David, thank you so much for joining me today, and I appreciate that. And we will go out with If Jesus Comes Back, favorite song, Joan Osborne. Thanks. We'll see you next week.